From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Everybody get ready to ramble. We're going to have a full hour of news, music reviews, a weather forecast for 2008. It's the Bryant Park Project.
Did your voice just change on the air?
It did. I have a little Peter Brady moment.
Yeah, that's
right
what I was going to say. When it's time to change, it's time to change.
I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. We just got to start by giving a little shout out to our friend Josh McClader. I don't know if that's how you say his last name. He emailed that he listens to us in Moscow when he's on the train. Helps him feel connected to the U.S. and the world of chatty news.
I don't mean to be presumptuous, Luke, but I'm going to say, Josh, this show is for you.
Absolutely.
How about that?
We have some things that Josh, I'm sure, will be very interested in as he takes the train around the gray city of Moscow. He said it was gray. I'm not making a value judgment. We're going to talk about Alberto Gonzalez. He resigned yesterday. Well, he resigned actually on Friday, but it sort of came out yesterday. We're going to talk to Jim Vandehei from Politico.com. We're also going to talk to a conservative blogger from Powerline.com, kind of get different reactions to the story.
Also, because it's Tuesday, lots of new music comes out every Tuesday. Something you're excited about, the new Pornographers. Something you've become excited about, R. Kelly.
Ironically, there's R. Kelly is not the new Pornographer.
Well, depends who you speak to about that. Also, Caribou plus a pick for best CD as far as I'm concerned. We're going to talk to Melissa Maris from Rolling Stone.
Also there, we had a story kind of over the weekend about a kid who hacked his iPhone so it could work on other cell phone networks. He actually traded this phone, and he traded for a pretty awesome deal, so we're going to talk about that. Plus, we've got a discussion of the Owen Wilson situation, rumors that he may have tried to end his life. Also, we've got the ramble. First, though, we've got today's top story.
It is on the cover of every major newspaper this morning, the recounting and the reaction to the resignation of the 80th Attorney General of the United States, 52-year-old Alberto Gonzalez. In case you didn't hear his resignation speech yesterday, the outgoing AG kept it short and sweet.
I have great admiration and respect for the men and women who work here. It is through their continued work that our country and our communities remain safe, that the rights and civil liberties of our citizens are protected, and the hopes and dreams of all of our children are secured. I often remind our fellow citizens that we live in the greatest country in the world, and that I have lived the American dream. Even my worst days as Attorney General have been better than my father's best days. Public service is honorable and noble, and I am profoundly grateful to President Bush for his friendship and for the many opportunities he has given me to serve the American people. Thank you, and God bless America.
Boy, considering how much work it was to become Attorney General, to stay in the seat, you think he would have wanted to soak it up a little bit more on his way out.
That was 39 seconds.
39 seconds. Short, I guess, and sweet. Along with all those headlines, there are lots of editorials to consider today. Let's look at what's going on with the editorial pages from around the country, what they're saying about Gonzalez's departure. We're going to start in the president's home state of Texas, where the Houston Chronicle writes, quote, Alberto Gonzalez is a decent man who embodied a tragic flaw. He could not distinguish between the best interests of the nation and the wishes of his longtime client, George W. Bush.
Over the Chicago Tribune, the editorial board weighed in with this. It's been a long time since the country has had an attorney general who could inspire real pride. But you have to go back to the Watergate scandal to find one who has done as much as Gonzalez to damage public confidence.
The Wall Street Journal, referring to Gonzalez as A.G. Piñata, acknowledged that he had made a political mistake, but stated, quote, his greatest mistake is that he underestimated the political assaults that would come his way once Democrats took Congress.
And we'll go from some really high praise to just, ooh, kick a guy when he's down. Mm-hmm. The Washington Times looked at his accomplishments in their editorial, actually. They said Mr. Gonzalez deserves further credit for his work in the confirmation of the nominations of John Roberts and Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court, which ranks as one or two of three signal achievements of the Bush administration. And then there was the New York Times that served this up. Alberto Gonzalez has finally done something important to advance the cause of justice. He has resigned.
So it sounds like the Wall Street Journal actually came the closest to sort of echoing what the president said. This is what he had to say.
It's sad that we live in a time when a talented and honorable person like Alberto Gonzalez is impeding from doing important work because his good name was dragged through the mud for political reasons.
Coming up in just about a minute or so, we'll get more into the Gonzalez story by talking to Jim Vandehei, the executive editor of Politico.com.
This is NPR.
But right now, it's time for the news. Here's Matt Martinez.
Thanks, guys. A federal judge says that former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega can be extradited to France once he completes his U.S. prison sentence for a 1992 drug trafficking conviction. The 72-year-old Noriega is due to be released from a Miami prison on September 9th. A report in the newspaper Roll Call says that Republican Idaho Senator Larry Craig pled guilty to a misdemeanor disorderly conduct charge stemming from an arrest at the Minneapolis airport. The newspaper reports that Craig was arrested in June by a plainclothes officer investigating complaints of lewd conduct in a men's restroom. Craig was fined $1,000 plus some court fees and was placed on unsupervised probation for a year. Foreign firefighters have joined the fight against the wildfires in Greece. The death toll from 5 days of blazes is at least 64. The fires are the worst in the country's memory. They've burned olive groves, forests, orchards, and homes. The government budgeted upward of $410 million for immediate relief, but Greek officials say that bill is expected to be much higher. A federal judge temporarily blocked a new Missouri abortion law yesterday. The law puts more abortion clinics under state supervision by categorizing them as outpatient surgery centers. Planned Parenthood says it would have to stop abortions at its Columbia and Kansas City offices while expensive and, quote, medically unnecessary renovations were made. The judge says he will hold a hearing on September 10th to determine whether to make the injunction permanent. Michael Vick said he was sorry yesterday. The apology came after formally entering a guilty plea to a dogfighting conspiracy charge. Vick says he takes full responsibility for his actions, which included killing pit bulls that didn't perform well. He apologized to the NFL and to his team, the Atlanta Falcons, and said he would redeem himself. A police officer in President Bush's motorcade died Monday after he crashed his motorcycle. 40-year-old Jermaine Casey crashed at the Albuquerque airport at a point where a road enters an underground parking garage. The accident comes less than a year after a crash in Hawaii killed another motorcycle officer accompanying the president. Mr. Bush issued a statement saying he was saddened by Casey's death and extraordinarily grateful for his protection. And a research group says that Mississippi is the country's fattest state, saying that more than 30% of adults are obese there. West Virginia and Alabama are right behind Mississippi. The study was conducted by the Trust for America's Health. I'm Matt Martinez. The news always online at npr.org. Back to you, Luke and Ellison.
Thank you, Matt and Martinez. The resignation of Alberto Gonzalez, the first Latino attorney general, he was in the job about 2.5 years, longtime friend of Mr. Bush, said in signals that we need a pro to help us read. Jim Vandehei is the executive editor of Politico.com. Hey, Jim.
How are you doing?
I'm doing just great. I'm going to ask you to give me two scenarios here. Give me one scenario where Mr. Gonzalez's exit is a good thing for Mr. Bush in the last, you know, months, 14 months of his presidency, and then one scenario in which Gonzalez's exit is bad for the Bush presidency.
I mean, I think the scenario where it's good is that, you know, that now that he had, that Karl Rove has resigned and that Gonzalez is stepping aside, that you have two of the more radioactive members of his inner circle gone, and that he'll turn increasingly to folks that are more accustomed to sort of the ways of Washington, people like Eddie Gillespie and his chief of staff Bolton on the inside, and try to work with Congress on just getting the budget done and get it right this year, and then find a compromise on Iraq that doesn't lead to even more divisiveness between the two parties. I think the bad scenario for Bush would be that he picks a successor that is similarly radioactive, and that we have a long, drawn-out fight on the Hill in trying to get this person confirmed. And the other thing that Bush has to worry about is now that Gonzalez is leaving, does it make him, if he is testifying more before Congress, does it make him more open to sharing a little bit more insight into what was happening in the White House?
I'm also wondering if Mr. Gonzalez absorbed some of the blows that might have been coming towards the president about Iraq and about other issues, that he was a little bit of a red herring.
He absorbed some. I mean, he certainly took a beating the last couple of months here in Washington. And yet you've got to believe that because he's not going to be on the inside anymore, that deflates a little bit of the enthusiasm among Democrats to keep going after him and hitting on this whole scandal regarding the firing of these U.S. attorneys or out around the country. I think Democrats, I take them at their word that they'll continue to pursue it. But if you think through sort of the strategic mind of Democrats right now, they have so many different targets that they want to investigate, and you have limited resources. So my assumption is that they're going to pick and choose those carefully. And I don't know that the U.S. attorney's firing remains as high a priority as it was before for Democrats.
I wonder if there's some part of Alberto Gonzalez that's kind of mad at President Bush. Like, he stuck by this guy for years. He, as you said, Jim, he just took a beating on Capitol Hill over the last few months, always, you know, sort of playing the good soldier, saying, I can't recall, and just looking kind of somewhat foolish, people would say. And then, you know, at the end of the day, it became more politically expedient, it would appear, for the White House to kind of jettison him. I wonder if he's like, come on, bro.
Well, you got to – they are close friends. I mean, they've had to have talked about this, and it's – I mean, like, we've seen this story before many times. We all knew how this narrative was going to end. It was going to end with his resignation. And
right.
The question was when, and every Republican you talk to is like, why did we wait until the end of August to do this when we all knew this is what was going to happen a couple of months ago? And you wonder why, because I know for a fact that people very, very close to Bush, right after the whole eruption of stories about the firing of these U.S. attorneys, a lot of those parts of the inner circle wanted Gonzalez gone at that point. And it was Bush who personally intervened and said, no way. And Gonzalez clearly said, yeah, I'd like to stick around too so I can go and be the White House pinata in the backyard of Congress for the next 2 months.
It's interesting. We've been talking about the timing of this. I'm in the conspiracy theory wagon that last week of August, most of the media on vacation. Oh no, Katrina anniversary. Let's do this on Monday. Let's just wipe this off the newspapers. That's me. Another NPR colleague said he thinks that some high level Republican just picked up the phone and said, "Okay, it's time." Either of those feasible to you?
I have an even more cynical view of it all, is that they're just so worn out that they're not even on their game anymore, because clearly you're trying to use August to bury some of these things and not have them be huge stories because people just don't pay as much attention to the news in August. But if that were the case, then you would do it the way they used to do it, which is do it at Friday at 7 o'clock, and by Monday it's gone. No one paid attention to it. Everyone's at the beach and hanging out with their kids. Instead, they wait on Monday. They dominate. They guarantee that essentially the story was going to dominate the news cycle. You know, Monday, Tuesday, and probably into the weekend. So if they were trying to bury it, it was pretty darn clumsy. And it kind of reflects, something that I've noticed with this White House. I mean, in the beginning, the first 4 or 5 years, you know, they were very good at sort of playing the communications game and knowing exactly what to say and when to say it and how to control information. They've gotten increasingly more sloppy at doing that. And I think part of that is that, you know, that Bush continues to lose those people that he's closest too. I mean, you now have a president who's essentially sitting in the White House without any of the people who helped get him there.
Yeah,
they're
Karen Hughes, Dan Bartlett.
All of his intimates.
Right,
yeah,
Karen Hughes, Dan Bartlett.
Yeah. Right.
I wondered if we're seeing
a
little...
It was never a big group of people. I mean, it's always been an oligarchy. I mean, there's been like 4 or 5 people who sit in a room and they make most of the decisions. I mean, that's not a caricature. That's essentially on the big decisions. That's reality. That's how they've been able to control the message and nothing ever gets leaked, because only 4 or 5 people are involved in the decision-making process often.
Do you think that we might see kind of a breakdown in discipline now that Karl Rove is gone, and, you know, that it's not going to be – things aren't going to be as sort of tight as they've been over the last – 5, whatever it is, 6 years?
You know what? Part of me thinks this is all completely irrelevant. I mean, you've got a president who's obviously a lame duck president, whose party at best has sort of lukewarm feelings towards him, operating with a Democratic Congress. He can't do anything. There is no incentive in this town among Republicans or Democrats to work with Bush to do anything of grand significance. So what can he do? He can do 2 things. He can do the federal budget, which by law he's got to do. They've got to get it done. They've got appropriations bill. They've got to get signed into law. They got to do it this year. They got to do it next. And he's got to manage the war. So I think, you know, the truth is, I mean, he's almost, you know, for the last year and a half, For better or worse, this has been essentially a one-issue presidency, and it's all he really cares about is Iraq and trying to figure out how do we get it right, how do we get out of there. I don't think that that changes. I mean, even immigration, I think he cares, and it was near and dear to his heart, you know, some time ago, but it was clear his heart wasn't in it this time around. Like, he was really, like, he's focused on Iraq, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think if Congress and the White House spent the next year and a half just trying to figure out what the heck we're going to do over there and how we get troops out of there, and at least beginning next year or at some point in the next couple of years, that's not a bad thing because it's kind of a big deal.
Jim Vandehei from Politico.com. Thanks for being with us, Jim.
Take care. Bye.
You know, coming up on the BPP, we've got this video of Miss Teen South Carolina, which if you have not seen it, prepare for a mind explosion.
And a lot of head shaking.
Of sadness.
A lot of head shaking. Also, New Music Tuesday had the new pornographers R. Kelly Caribou and my man, Lyle Lovett. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
By special request of supervising senior producer Matt Martinez, he said yesterday, can we please play some Cool in the Gang tomorrow?
I'm chair dancing right now. So is Luke. The people in the other part office building are going to catch on one day and wonder what the heck we're doing. There's a big window looking out.
I mean, they raise a fair question. How are you going to do it if you really don't want to dance by standing on the wall? It's the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank. It feels weird to say NPR News after you get done talking about Cool in the Gang.
Who am I? Allison Stewart.
Yes.
All right, coming up, we're going to tell you about some surfers who are protesting this super ferry that was going between the Hawaiian Islands. I said was because they were able to actually, the environmentalists there, have it shut down. We'll get more details on that with the attorney work in that case. But right now, it's time for the news. Well, it's not news you can use, but news that will infuse your day. Oh, rhyming
confuse?
Is bad.
I don't know. It's the ramble.
Bad.
I swear we don't need scripts. George Hotz, the 17-year-old who hacked his iPhone so it would work with other cell phone networks other than AT&T, has traded this hacked phone for a new Nissan 350Z and three new iPhones. He wrote on his blog, quote, "This has been a great end to a great summer."
I just like this kid. All the way around, from the quote to the action. Hey, thieves in England stole a prosthetic hand from a motorcycle handle. This young man, he left his hand on the bike, went in to see his girlfriend, came out 2 hours later, gone. He said it was actually the first time he'd ever left the hand on the bike. He hadn't had the hand that long. It was a recent addition to his life after a subtraction after an accident.
Was it a motorcycle accident?
I believe it was a biking accident.
Well, it is ironic, if nothing else. Luke Skywalker's lightsaber. Speaking of people who lost hands, remember that?
Yes.
That famous scene. Luke Skywalker's lightsaber, the one that's used in the original Star Wars movie, is going to be sent to the International Space Station as part of the film's 30th anniversary celebration. Because you know what Star Wars needs is more hype.
Yeah.
It's a little indie film you may have heard of. The lightsaber will be flown from California to Texas by Chewbacca and delivered to the Houston Space Center by R2-D2.
Maybe their fans could just be a little more into it as well. Oh, yeah, this is also a fantastic reason to go to our website, npr.org/Bryant Park, because it's a great excuse to put that lightsaber kid on the site again.
Oh, yeah,
it's up there. I did that right before we came in. I was almost late trying to embed the video.
The kid with the mop handle that's doing his... Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. This is really disturbing. Actor Owen Wilson is under close supervision after what the Associated Press is saying was an apparent suicide attempt in Los Angeles on Sunday night. He has released a statement saying, quote, "I respectfully ask the media to allow me to receive care and heal in private during this difficult time." Very funny actor, Wedding Crashers, Academy Award nominee, which I didn't remember when doing research for Royal Tenenbaums. He co-wrote that.
You know, I mean, I think a psychologist would say, of course, there's no profile for somebody who, you know, is depressed or suicidal. But I got to say, he's just not a guy I would see on screen in his roles and think that's a guy who, you know, seems like he's dealing with that stuff.
I hope he's okay.
Well, that, on a somber note, wraps up today's ramble. The 2008 Farmer's Almanac comes out today. If you've never read it, and Allison, there was always an old copy of the Farmer's Almanac in the bathroom of my dad's sign shop in Seattle.
True?
Yeah, I would. So that was how I became – I just realized that story goes to kind of a disturbing place.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you haven't ever read it, if you didn't stop by Signworks on Aurora Avenue in Seattle during the 80s, the Farmer's Almanac is a sort of folksy paperback little book full of folksy wisdom and folksy jokes and – folksy weather reports. Did I mention it's folksy?
Yeah. Go to thesaurus.com to look for another word for folksy for you.
This year's edition is predicting a two-faced winter, some cold stuff in the east, but I guess warmer than usual temperatures in the west. And the weather predictions in the Farmer's Almanac are made 2 years in advance by a mysterious character known as Caleb Weatherby. That's not his real name, apparently. He uses secret weather predictions, a secret formula that's based on sunspots, the position of the planets, and tidal action of the moon. And we've got the editor of the Farmer's Almanac, Peter Geiger, here to talk to us. Hi, Peter.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Great. Last year, the Farmer's Almanac said it was going to be a really cold winter, and then it actually turned out to be kind of warm. Did you guys get that one wrong? Did Caleb mess up?
Well, what happened was the El Nino effect. You know, we do our weather 2 years in advance, as you said.
Sure.
El Nino comes.
Blame immigrants again.
The El Nino came up just a few months in advance. And so what happened was, although we were wrong on the temperature, pretty much what we talked about in terms of snowfall was going to be, for the East Coast, was going to be February and March. And that's when the snow fell. So there wasn't, we didn't miss much in terms of snow, but the cold definitely. On the flip side, we were completely correct in Colorado and some of the places that got murdered last year. So, you know, you're not going to be right everywhere, but I think we do a pretty good job.
You guys, there's a lot of secrecy that kind of surrounds the process by which you guys come up with these weather predictions. I'm just wondering, do you have like a Doppler radar or weather satellite that's built out of wood, out of like a wagon wheel that you made?
There's a concept whose time hasn't come. We use a mathematical formula. We apply it to certain things like sunspot activity, I think, as you mentioned, and it allows us to do the weather 2 years in advance. And it seems to have worked pretty well since we're still talking about it 191 years later. We believe that we're a bride's best friend, and as such, this year we decided to hold a contest because I'm always getting questions about when the best day is for a wedding, and so this year we decided that somebody who has not had a good weather for their wedding can participate in the worst wedding weather contest. So essentially, you go to my website, farmersalmanac.com, and you're able to plug in information if you had a rain or tornado or hurricane. And at the very end of the contest, we're going to have America vote on the worst wedding for some poor couple, and we're going to reward them with a Windjammer barefoot cruise in the Caribbean next year.
Nice.
A 7-day cruise or an L.L. Bean gift certificate or a dinner for two. So, just the whole concept of, you know, you got to have the perfect day, but it isn't always perfect. And I used an example in the 2008 Farmer's Almanac of a couple that I went to their wedding and predicting a good day. And it was the first time I ever went to a wedding that wasn't perfect. And it rained. It was awful.
I got to tell you, the prize jumping from L.L. Bean to a Windjammer cruise, that's a big leap.
Or how about dinner for two? That's is it their choice of one of the three?
If you are the worst, if you are the best of the worst, you'll get a Windjammer cruise 7 days in the Caribbean, not during the hurricane season, hopefully.
There's not just weather in the almanac, though. There's a kind of a human interest crusade you guys sort of launch with each edition. What's the one for 2008?
Well, I think in 2008, we have a whole series of things. You know, if you looked at almanacs in the 1800s, they were kind of a guide to good living. They told people what to do and what the issues were, you know, how to kiss and how to date and how to do this and how to do that. Today, what are our big issues? Well, global warming is a big issue, and while I stay out of the politics of global warming, we do offer suggestions on how people can do things better and not pollute as much. And so my theory is that if you take care of yourself, eventually it takes care of the world, and I stay away from the politics. We have a Create a Year of Wellness in which if you follow the steps for all 12 months, you're going to have a healthy year, because 1 month deals with cholesterol, 1 month deals with breast cancer and so forth. We have issues on how to protect your identity, so that's fairly topical, fairly new. And we also have one on ice storms, because people, particularly in the South, are always concerned about ice. And so we talk about what makes an ice or an ice storm and what to do about it. So there's a lot of, I think, really good reading in the publication. It's very timely. And we have, by the way, an orange cover because there's different almanacs out there. And I want to be sure that if...
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to ask you as we let you go, Peter Geiger from the Farmer's Almanac. There's another... Your rival publication, which is even slightly older, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's called The Old Farmer's Almanac. I guess, why didn't you guys pick a name that was more different? That just must be so annoying.
Well, because back in the 1800s, there were hundreds of almanacs, and everybody was a farmer's almanac in those days because almanacs didn't go very far.
I know, so. But seriously, I mean, you should have called it Ricky's Special Weather Mysteries.
Well, I was hoping
mysteries.
That they would change their name.
Oh, yeah.
And that would solve my problem.
How's that working out?
Not too good so far.
All right. Well, Peter Geiger from The Farmer's Almanac, thanks for coming on the Bryant Park Project.
Thank you very much. And once again, farmersalmanac.com is a great way to communicate with me as well.
All right. Thank you.
You know,
farmers were always known for plugging their websites. One of the hallmarks of the agrarian history of this country.
Because they're folksy. They're often homey, down home as well. Yes, I was on thesaurus.com. The rest are really kind of not very nice.
The rest other ways to say folksy?
Yeah. Oh, sort of okay. Like crude and stuff like that. So we'll
all
stick
right.
with folksy.
That is the Farmer's Almanac. I guess I see next up on the list, we're going to get a news update.
This is NPR.
From Matt Martinez.
That's right. I'm sitting right here. I'm always here for you.
You know, they told me right before the show, you need to write down cue to news on the script. It's not in there. And I wrote
you?
It down. I did, and I totally ignored it.
Well,
I'm sorry.
These things happen. A federal judge says that former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega can be extradited to France once he completes his U.S. prison sentence for a 1992 drug trafficking conviction. The 72-year-old Noriega is due to be released from a Miami prison on September 9th. Republican U.S. Senator Larry Craig confirmed that he had pleaded guilty to a charge of disorderly conduct earlier this month after he was arrested in June in a men's toilet at a Minnesota airport. He was arrested by plainclothes police officers investigating complaints of lewd conduct in the men's public restroom at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Michael Vick said he's sorry. The apology came after formally entering a guilty plea to a dogfighting conspiracy charge. Vic says he takes full responsibility for his actions and said that he would redeem himself. And a research group says that Mississippi is the country's fattest state, saying that more than 30% of adults are obese. West Virginia and Alabama are right behind Mississippi. The study was conducted by the Trust for America's Health. In other news, my personal trainer says I have 30% body fat. The news is always online at npr.org. Back to you, Luke and Allison. 30%.
Yeah, I thought we should do the show with the mics on this time. This time.
We're sitting here defending Matt. No, Matt, that's not true. That's not true. And our mics aren't on.
That's the
so
world's,
we were defending you,
world's
Matthew.
World's most depressing statistic, by the way, is that Matt has 30% body fat because Matt is so much more trim than I am. I don't even want to know. Which is, okay, the thing with these obesity studies, and you hear the statistic like 30% of adults are obese. That sounds ridiculous. But I'm surprised at actually how low the threshold is for being obese. It's not like one of those people that's trapped in their house.
Yes.
It's just somebody who's carrying an extra 15 or 20. I'm approaching.
I don't know. Are you doing justification over there? Yes. What's the date? It's Tuesday.
The 28th?
Yeah, Tuesday the 28th. You know what happens on Tuesday? A lot of new music releases.
Oh, right.
Which is something we like to do on the Bryant Park Project. So we do want to bring in Melissa Maris from Rolling Stone magazine, who's going to present to us some of the best and some of the rest as well. Hey, Melissa.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing well. Let's start with something new from some group that might be new to a lot of people, an outfit called Caribou.
Yes, this is the alias of a guy named Dan Snaith, who's from Ontario. And he started off as an electronic musician and then kind of got more into psychedelic music. It seems like it's kind of a mix between like a Grateful Dead background and some more electronic artists who are more current, like Aphex Twin. And he has a kind of a meld between those two influences that's really nice.
And what's the name of the new release?
The new release is called Andorra.
All right, let's listen to a song called Sandy from Andorra by Caribou. So Melissa, is this, can you go see Caribou live, or is this all just a studio creation?
Yes, well, Dan Snaith plays all of the instruments himself, but you can see him live. He used to play in a group called Manitoba, where they do kind of similar music, but then it was played by a band live, and he recorded it all of himself in the studio. This is kind of a similar situation, where sometimes he'll play it live himself, and sometimes he plays with other musicians on stage.
All right, the next thing up is something we can listen to and watch and maybe shake your head because you can't believe it's true. The Hip Hopera of R. Kelly. It's this Trapped series. Give people a little background on the Trapped series.
Oh, where to start? Well, it sounds basically like you're trapped in the bar with somebody who's telling you the longest dream they've ever had in their life. And basically, it's about
a guy
named
Sylvester
who is having an affair with a woman named Kathy, who is married to a man named Rufus, who's having an affair with a man named Chuck. And it just goes on from there. Everybody's having different affairs. There's all sorts of backstories and plot twists and just a really long, involved, complicated, amazing series.
All right, let's listen to a little bit so people can kind of understand what we're talking about.
Watch your mouth, woman, go to hell, Randolph. Oh, you don't tell me what to
Can't
do.
Nobody
I'm
tell
a grown
you
ass woman. I could do whatever the hell I wanna do.
We'll do it then.
I'ma do it then.
Do it then.
I'ma do it then.
Gonna look.
I'm gonna look.
And I hope a pigeon fly by here and shit on your face.
Oh Lord, forgive me for what I said. Woman got
if it do,
going
if it do.
Now there are some music critics that will haul off and pop you one if you say, if I ask this question, and you're on the phone, so I think I'm safe. Is this a joke? Like, is there any irony in this, or is this straight up for real?
Well, this is the hot topic of debate right now that everybody has their opinion about. I mean, I personally believe that R. Kelly knows exactly what he's doing, that he thinks it's funny, and that it's kind of an intentional play on the self-seriousness that a lot of R&B songs have lately. You know, you have a lot of it's funny, you think of like a traditional R&B song that's on the radio right now, it's always like, you know, I'm going to kiss you, I'm going to seduce you, all these things I'm going to do, mm-hmm. but they're so mundane in this song. It's like, I'm going to walk out of the closet, and then I'm going to stand there, and then I'm going to go back in the closet. And he's just so intentionally mundane and step-by-step with this that I've got to believe that he knows it's a joke and he knows it's funny.
But let me speak up in defense. I haven't seen the second one, but the first Trap in the Closet, it's you might start out watching it kind of ironically, thinking, oh, this is going to be a lark. It is totally engaging once you start. For some reason that I can't even really explain, it's something about the rhythm of it. It's something about how ridiculous the plot is. But you actually find yourself going, what's going to happen next with the little person who's hiding under the sink? And you're really interested.
Well, absolutely. Well, every chapter starts with or ends with a cliffhanger. So it's definitely, you know, you want to know what's happening next. And I know that when the 13th chapter premiered, people have been waiting a long time to find out what was happening with Sylvester.
So the DVDs will be available. That's what I will be getting Luke for Christmas. You can also see it on IFC.
And if you don't, I hope a pigeon poops on your face.
And R. Kelly will be in court in September for charges of having sex with an underage girl. But we'll move on from that. A release that Luke got very excited when he heard about this. The New Pornographers. It's called Challengers. Explain the whole New Pornographers supergroup issue.
Okay, well, this is a bunch of different musicians from Canada, a lot of whom have side projects. So AC Newman has his own side project. There's a guy named Dan Bahar who plays in a group called Destroyer. Nico Case is on some of these songs, who has her own kind of alt-country career. So it's a lot of very strong players playing in this group together. And this album, Challengers, is a lot more organic record for them. They've brought in a string section and harps and flutes and French horns and just a really nice power pop sound.
Let's take a listen to this track from the New Pornographers. My Rights Versus Yours. It's off the Challengers album by the New Pornographers. And I was reading a little bit about it, and apparently the leader of the group moved from Vancouver to Brooklyn, as what was described as hipster Brooklyn. Do you think you can hear that at all in the record?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two songs. One of the things that's really great about them is there's so much intricacy in their lyrics. So there's two songs on here that are both about moving to New York. One of them is Myriad Harbor and the other one is called Unguided. And both Dan Bahar and Niecy Newman moved to New York. And in the first song, in Myriad Harbor, Dan Bahar has this line. He says, "Look up for once and see just how the sun sets in the sky." And then later on in Unguided, Niecy Newman kind of answers that by saying, "There's something unguided in the sky tonight." So it's kind of nice. These songs are answering each other, and these two things about the New York skyline that I really like.
The only criticism I've read, well, I've actually read a few people that are not so in love with this record, but this gal, Nico Case, who's in it, who has a lot of fans on her own, some people think she's a little underutilized on this record.
Well, it's funny, you know, I think that I've interviewed her before, and she would say that it's not her place to kind of dominate that record. Like, she has her own solo career, which is really fantastic, and she really wants to be in this band, from what she said, to, you know, have the interactions between all these different players.
Melissa Maris from Rolling Stone magazine. Thanks for all the tips today.
Great, thanks so much.
All right, so Luke, there's one record that Melissa did not review, which is by an artist I love. Mm-hmm. I just love Lyle Lovett. I love him. Mm-hmm. To the point when he got married to Julia Roberts, I had two friends who called me to make sure I was okay.
Well, not to mention that yesterday in the meeting, we mentioned someone who will remain nameless, who is in the same line of work that we are, who dated him. And your reaction, cover your ears, Bill Wolf, wherever you are, your reaction was, "I had a shot." You were so depressed that, like, you were like, wait, he would date a newscaster?
Jeez, man.
It wasn't Ann Taylor.
And it wasn't Carl Castle either. So this is his 13th album. I happen to love Lyle Lovett for many reasons. But one of the things is he always has, it's called Lyle Lovett and his large band. Russ Kunkel is on drums. He's got Bella Fleck on banjo. He also has Jerry Douglas on dobro. So it's Lyle Lovett.
Or Dojo, as MJ Davis calls it.
Lyle Lovett and his large band. And the thing about whenever you listen to a Lyle Lovett record, it just sounds so familiar. Mm-hmm. And he has this really great ability to mix swing and blues and country and jazz. And it's just sort of like, okay, this is my food analogy of the day. It's like gingerbread.
Mm.
Like, it's, you know, when you get smelled gingerbread, you know it smells good. It's kind of special. It's not cornbread. It's not zucchini bread. It's not banana bread. It's gingerbread. And sometimes it's good with whipped cream, and sometimes it's good with tea, sometimes it's good with a shot of rum in it. That's what, like, listening to Lyle Lovett.
I'm voting for door number three. I have to say, I have never, ever turned off a Lyle Lovett song that was on the radio, you know?
It's true. So I want you to sit back, enjoy a nice slice of Lyle Lovett's new record. This is a song called No Big Deal.
Sunday morning, the coffee's on. That gray cat's still yawning because Saturday's gone. And I still feel the feeling of how you felt upon me.
The name of the record is called It's Not Big, It's Large.
That's music that makes you want to call your ex-girlfriend. That's the problem. It totally reminds you of some Sunday morning when you weren't fighting for once.
Or it could be the solution, depending on the way you look at it.
All right.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Hey, everybody, I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. We have got the Miss Teen South Carolina. It's a great video, but luckily for us as a radio program, or we're not supposed to call it a radio program, as a 24-hour news and information stream.
Audio service.
It also works on an audio level because the sound is... It's magnificent. So we're going to play some of that coming up in a minute. First, though, we're going to take another whack at the big story today, the news that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is stepping down. And we were thinking, for a guy who really, really stuck by the president, I mean, to the point of kind of alienating a lot of other people in Washington, you would think that conservatives, supporters of the president, would be just sort of lining up to eulogize Alberto Gonzalez and talk about how great he was. But that has not so much been the case. Here's what Rich Lowry wrote on townhall.com. He said, Gonzalez never should have been selected as attorney general in the first place. His appointment speaks to a sentimentality on Bush's part. And here's what Paul Marengoff wrote on powerline.com. I've never been a fan of Gonzalez, but I can't help feeling sorry for him. Later he says, Gonzalez's only real offense seems to have been mediocrity. Sort of hardly a ringing endorsement from the right. We've actually got Paul Marengoff with us now to talk about the conservative reaction to the departure of the guy that President Bush called, mysteriously anyway, Fredo. Why did he call him Fredo? That's not any derivation of Alberto or Gonzalez.
You got me there.
Well, what accounts for this, Paul? It seems like if you're somebody who supports the president, this was a guy who was very dedicated to the president's cause and took some pretty severe beatings on his behalf. Why are the people on the right not lining up to love on Alberto Gonzalez today?
Well, I think there are two reasons. First of all, he was always viewed by conservatives as a bit of a threat, quite frankly. His closeness with Bush suggested to conservatives that he might eventually make the Supreme Court, and he was simply not considered by conservatives, including me, sufficiently conservative or even solidly conservative for purposes of that office. So there was that initial distrust. And then secondly, I mean, conservatives are no longer enamored with President Bush in many cases, and they're sort of there's sort of a distancing of conservatives from this administration for some good reasons and maybe for some opportunistic reasons.
Well, we earlier in the show asked Jim VandeHei from Politico.com to kind of sketch this out for us. If this is good news or bad news for the president, what do you make of this?
I think it really depends on what happens next. I mean, in a well-functioning political system, the demise of a mediocre attorney general would be a particularly an unpopular one, would be a good thing for the administration and for the country, because it would give the president the opportunity to, improve upon the holder of the position. Unfortunately, our system isn't working all that well, and I think we may get a pretty ugly circus-like confirmation process in which the Democrats, among other things, may demand that the president appoint a special prosecutor to look into what I think is a non-scandal over these attorney generals. And so, I mean, that I think would be bad for the administration and frankly, bad for the country.
Is this a bad time to be a conservative right now? I mean, you've got all these Karl Rove and Alberto Gonzalez dropping like flies. Democrats are in control of Congress.
Conservatives are used to bad times. In fact, conservatives used to.
How can you say that? You guys have had the White House and Congress for the last, however many years.
Right, but there are long periods of wilderness. We could call the wilderness years. The Democrat, if you go back to say 1960, I mean, the White House has been back and forth. Congress has been predominantly Democrat, and so yeah, I mean, this it was happier, more fun to be a conservative in 2002 than it is right now. But this is this is sort of the yin and yang of politics, and we deal with it.
And Paul, if you could make a recommendation to whomever's in charge, to President Bush, like, this is who should be your new attorney general, who would it be?
Well, I'm a little hesitant to do that because of I don't know.
Oh, come on. Who would you give a thumbs up if you saw it come on across breaking news?
All right. Ted Olson.
Solicitor General.
Theodore Olson, right?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Because?
Well, I think the qualities I'm looking for is, first of all, another conservative who in particular sees the war on terror and the legal issues associated that with the same way Gonzalez did, because I think Gonzalez is very good on that. And I think Olson, although maybe a little more moderate, would fill that bill. Secondly, it needs to be someone who's respected inside the halls of the Justice Department. And Olson is widely respected and was the Solicitor General there, a very successful one in terms of his win rate before the Supreme Court for several years in recent times. So I think he's respected. And third, I think he'd do well before Congress. And I think it's important that the nominee be someone who the Democrats will either have to confirm or look bad blocking.
See, that wasn't so hard. Just a well-thought-out answer.
I'm sure you know, there are people out there who are going to say, you know, why didn't he say this one or that one? But I would say Ted Olson.
That would presume people listen to this show, which is, I think, first faulty.
I'm here under false pretenses?
Just to quickly jump topics as we kind of wrap things up on your blog today, you mentioned this kind of scandal that's building around Larry Craig. He's a senator from Idaho, a Republican, and there's news out that he pled guilty to disorderly conduct in a Minnesota airport bathroom, and the allegation being basically that he was propositioning a male undercover police officer for sex. Is this something that we should care about?
Well, to some extent, first of all, I mean, it has political implications because, you know, that seat is up in 2008. So what does it mean politically? I think it means that Craig is gone either now or will be pushed aside in time for the election. And Idaho, being an extremely conservative state, as a good state, a good chance Republicans will hold the seat. I mean, should we care about it from a moral standpoint? I mean, I think, you know, people who solicit sex in you know, public laboratories don't normally belong in the U.S. Senate. But it's, that's really, for the voters of Idaho ultimately to decide and for Craig to decide whether he thinks he can face them.
Hmm. Paul Mierengoff from the conservative blog Powerline, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
And now to something really rather special. I saw this happen live, I want to say, and I had to turn it off because it was so embarrassing. This Miss Teen USA competition. I was sitting on the couch. I just finished doing Countdown NBC. I was really tired surfing through. And there was this young woman answering this question. I don't know if you've seen the video on YouTube. In case you haven't, take a listen.
Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so.
U.S. Americans.
Because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as
that's when I turned.
South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like
the
such
Iraq.
As, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. or should help South Africa,
mm-hmm.
and should help the
also known as South
Asian
Africa.
Countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much, South Carolina.
No, thank you. Holy mackerel. That was, by the way, Miss South Carolina USA, Lauren Caitlin Upton. It was the final round of the talent competition. This was the kind of thing that you kind of have to almost listen to twice or watch twice, because the first time it just blows your mind.
I think let's listen to it one more time and we won't say anything.
Okay.
Just so you can get the full vibe.
I get it. I get the hint. I'll shut up.
No, it wasn't the hint. It was just like when you think about it, like you just got to hear it with just as.
All right. One more time. Lauren Caitlin Upton.
Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. Or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much, South Carolina.
Such as?
My favorite is at the end, for our children, because that'll get me off.
It's just like a random string of words that, I mean, they're...
It's like chocolate rain. Somebody just needs to remix that in a chocolate
rain. It all
rain.
Comes together. It's just like she said every word that came through the transom of her mind, regardless if it was in any way related to the word that came before or after it. She starts to say, I think she starts to say Osama at one point, and then she just throws in random such as. Then she says America or South Africa. Obviously, I mean the same country.
And Iraq.
Okay, but here the good news for her, I guess, is that she was on the Today Show this morning, was it this morning or yesterday? I think it was today. And she was able to – they let her re-answer the question, and here is what she said.
Okay, so let me ask you that question again. The question is, recent polls have shown that a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is, Caitlin?
Well, personally, my friends and I, we know exactly where the United States is on our map.
Such as?
I don't know anyone else who doesn't. And if the statistics are correct, I believe that there should be more emphasis on geography in our education so people will learn how to read maps better.
Yeah.
In South Africa. or Osama, such as.
You know
as.
Who really loses in all of this? Hillary Cruz, who actually won the thing. Because was she on the Today Show this morning? No.
Oh, yeah.
Miss Colorado got a rock. Not the rock, but like a rock like Charlie Brown. Everybody else gets candy and
right.
he gets a rock.
Right. Well, that's, you know, the thing for her is that about that re-answering is that, you know, she had like 2 days to think about it, to ponder this. And that's what she came up with. I think I would say it was about 15% better.
When you're surprised after that first answer?
I don't know.
That it took her 2 days to come up with
she
that
She did
one?
Get third place, by the way, in the whole thing, which is... Like, that didn't knock her out of the competition. That answer did not knock her out of the competition.
Fourth place, Dan says.
Fourth place?
Yeah.
Were you watching it, Dan? All right. I can't wait till we get that microphone so you can actually hear what the people in there are saying. Because I think that the 10 listeners to this production think we're just insane. Like, we just hear voices.
Well, let's say congratulations to Hillary Carol Cruz, the actual winner of that competition.
Yes.
And let's get some news headlines from Matt Martinez.
This is NPR.
Thanks, guys. What?
Nothing
no?
at all.
Okay. All right. I thought you had something more to add.
Whatever. We can talk about it later. Okay. It involves chocolate rain.
Okay. Republican Senator from Idaho, Larry Craig, pled guilty to misdemeanor disorderly conduct. Police officers say he attempted to engage in lewd conduct in a men's restroom. The death toll is around 64 in Greece. Wildfires have been burning for 5 days. Authorities say they are under control. Michael Vick says he's sorry for dogfighting and that he will redeem himself. And Mississippi is a fattest state. A new study says that more than 30% of adults there are obese. The South dominates the top 10 fattest states. Here they are, top 10. West Virginia, Alabama, Louisiana, South Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, Arkansas, Indiana, and Michigan. The fittest state in the country. You guys have any guesses on the fittest state in the country?
Utah.
No.
Oh.
Colorado.
It's all
the skiing and the
altitude.
Health, yes.
And the chocolate rain.
Well, those are some of the stories on our radar. The stories are always online at npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez with 30% Body Fat.
It's a bird, it's a plane, it's Super Ferry, a 350-foot catamaran with a capacity of 800 or so people, 200 or so cars. It made its virgin voyage over the weekend, but then it ran into some legal kryptonite. A group of environmentalists paddled out on their surfboards in front of the ship during its first trip. Actually, the Coast Guard had to come in and clear the surfing protesters out of the way. Now, the environmentalists who are protesting this ferry, saying it's going to hurt the environment, it might hurt humpback whales, et cetera, they went to court on Monday to get an injunction to stop the boat from sailing at all because the parent company apparently didn't have the required environmental report. We're going to get into both parts of this story. First, we want to go to Mahana Vaughn, who's joining us from Kauai. Mahana, you were one of the surfers out there?
Yes, I was. Aloha.
All right, so tell me what that experience was like, getting on your surfboard and paddling out in front of this enormous 300-foot boat.
It was scary, and I think it was something that many people didn't plan. We saw the ferry on the horizon, and it got so close so quickly, it moved so fast, and in no time, it was huge, as big as the pulley at the entrance to the harbor, and people just started to paddle out, and no one looked to see how many people were there and how many people were already in the water. People just went, and I think at the height of it, there were about 70 to 75 of us in the water. It was hard to tell because there were surfers, there were swimmers, there were people on kayaks, there were people fishing, there were people on stand-up paddle boards, and a growing crowd on the jetty behind us. It felt like 400 people, 450. It was hard to make count from the water, but we could hear them chanting and yelling their support, and we could always hear their voices across the water.
So for how long did you actually hold up the Super Ferry from being able to go on its route? How long were you out there?
We were in the water, most of us, for a total of about 4 hours. And people came and went at different times, but generally most people stayed there for 3.5 to 4 hours.
So
by the time we paddled in, it was 9:30 at night.
So why did you decide that it was important for you to go stay on your surfboard in front of this huge boat for hours and hours? Why is this personally an important issue to you?
For me, it's important mainly for two reasons. The first, in Hawaiian, we say ho'okipa, which means to welcome. Kipa is to visit, but ho'okipa is active, and it means to cause the visit, to host the visit, to facilitate. And we in Kauai have always hosted people from all over the world with much aloha, and we hope to continue to do that. In the case of the Super Ferry, it felt like an effort to go directly around the people of Kauai and directly around our concerns for what is best for this place and for how to help people visit responsibly and with aloha in a way that ensures that Kauai remains beautiful and special for our families as well as for people to continue to visit. And it felt like the Super Ferry was not consulting the people.
I wanted to be able to bring in a lawyer who's been working on this case as well. And thank you for your time, Ahana Vaughn. Thank you so much for telling us about your day. I do want to bring in Isaac Hall, who has been working on behalf of the environmentalists. Mahana talked about this a little bit, Isaac, that this company says that the environmentalists are saying this company did not have the sufficient reports that they needed. Why was this boat allowed to sail if they didn't get these sufficient reports?
Well, first off, I want to thank Mahana and everybody on Kauai for their de facto temporary restraining order. It's wonderful what they've done there. What happened in this case was that the Hawaii Department of Transportation and the Hawaii Super Ferry relied on what I would have to say are bogus exemptions from our Hawaiian environmental law, which is not in any way really different from the national environmental law either. There are exemptions, but these exemptions were abused.
I contacted the Super Ferry organization. I do want to present their side. They gave a response to this legal action and these what they call accusations. They say they are disappointed about all of this. For more than 3 years, this is their words, Hawaii Super Ferry has met all the requirements of the State Department of Transportation, including provisions pertaining to environmental review. The company complied with and in many instances exceeded Hawaii and federal environmental regulations. What's your response to that, Mr. Hall?
That's an absolute lie. They did rely on the exemptions, but the Hawaii Supreme Court, after hearing oral argument on our case, reversed in an unprecedented order that they issued 5 hours after oral argument, reversed the exemptions that they were relying on. So they did not, the exemptions that they're relying on are false. Now, as far as having prepared any documents that exceed or are as good as the environmental documents required by law, that's absolutely false as well. They've never prepared any document that allows public participation or allows the public an ability to participate in the preparation of in the assessment of the environmental impacts of this project. The point of doing an environmental analysis before a project is implemented is it allows the public to participate in that process and to develop mitigation measures prior to the implementation of a project. That's the whole point.
Is you just want this report to be done. You want that.
No, I want the report to be done, the public to be able to participate, want mitigation measures developed before the project starts. That's what all of us have been asking for. And instead, what they wanted to do was to rush and get started and look at the impacts later. That's just not the way our environmental law, as our legislature passed it, works.
Well, we'll hope people investigate it further. Isaac Hall, the attorney on the side of the environmentalists in this dispute, thanks for waking up so early and joining us on the Bryant Park Project.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Mahana.
That's what I wanted to ask that surfer lady. Was like, what was harder, paddling out in front of this giant ferry or getting up at 5 in the morning to be on the Bryant Park Project? That has been the Bryant Park Project for today. Thank you for listening. Dan Pashman directed the show. MJ Davis produced. Lauren Sporer, Josh Rogerson engineered. Matt Martinez with the news and supervising and the producer of the senior kind. And I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Join us again tomorrow.
Oh, we're doing a show tomorrow. Jeez.
Gonna do it if you really don't wanna dance by standing on the wall.
Get your back up off the wall.
Tell me, how you gonna do it if you really don't wanna dance by standing on the wall?